It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Hello again, Interior Alaska. Welcome back to the program we call Alaska Tracks, where we listen to excerpts from interviews I have recorded over the years with hunters and hunting guides, trappers and biologists. I'm Randy Zarnke, and I'll be your host. Hopefully you'll find these recordings both entertaining and educational. Today's featured guest is Jake Phillips of Pelican, a small community in southeast Alaska. Jake grew up around the commercial fishing industry and made it the focus of his adult life. He also managed to do more than his share of hunting and trapping. In this first segment, Jake tells us about his early years and the mentors who helped him become successful. He talks at length about the details of his trapping endeavors.
Well, I was born in Juneau in 1931, and my family lived in the Chichagof Mine. That's on the same island as Pelican is here. And Juneau was the nearest hospital, of course, so I was born there and went back to the Chichagof Mine and spent the first 9 years of my life there. And there was lots of fishermen and trappers and moonshiners and those type of people came through. And a lot of old-timers living out in the sticks. And when they couldn't pan gold or whatever they did to catch a fish, well, most of them went out and tried to catch a mink or an otter or something that they could sell to buy victuals for the next week. And so that's kind of where I got started, just hanging out with people that had to do it for a lifestyle. And then I moved to Sitka and went to high school there. Well, I met some more of the same type people that come from that old-time working class of Alaskans. Rather than hang around the pool hall or something like that, I hung around the fur shed and learned to skin mink and stretch otter and seals, and we hunted seals for bounties and eagles, and I learned to do all that stuff, and mostly from these old-timers that I mentioned. And my family wasn't really involved in it because they were working people. They had a steady job. My dad was a plumber and my mother was an office worker, but I had plenty of friends that worked in the outdoor life, fishing and trapping and so on. Almost too numerous to mention names, but one man stands out in my young life, and he taught me an awful lot about trapping. He grew up on a Fox Island by Petersburg, and his name was Harold Jenny, and he just passed away just recently. I think he was 85. I visited him over in the long-term care Petersburg about a year ago. Harold taught me an awful lot about trapping. He was more willing to go out. I went with him. I went on his boat and we spent a couple seasons together and I learned the basics. And I had another outstanding partner was Ted Kirkman from Sitka. Ted was born and raised in Alaska and married to a native woman, had a family, and he was one of these people that needed to trap in the wintertime. And I hung around long enough to finally got the chance to go partners and got my first baptism under fire, you might say, and learning how to do the business, to set the traps and where to set them and what kind of bait to use, if you use bait and blind sets. In those days, we didn't have any snares. I don't know whether they were available or not, but we didn't have any, and we certainly didn't have any of the killer type traps that I happen to like now. And all we had was the old style, the 1.5 long spring and double spring otter trap, and number 4s or 48s. Basically, our bread and butter was mink and otter. I don't think there was a marten on the island then. If there was, they were so few and far between that we didn't even consider them until probably well into the 50s. In the early part of my career, after I got out of high school, I went right to a logging camp, a fishing boat, and began to make my living that way. And of course, in the wintertime, there was no logging or no fishing. And in order to make a few dollars, I wound up trapping. And I liked it. I had a lot of fun at it. I never was considered a good trapper by any means. It wasn't a full-time occupation, but the fact is that I enjoyed every minute of it. And I wish I could go back and do it all again, but I'm just flat beyond that. Health-wise, I can't hobble around good enough. I wouldn't mind going out. I had a good young partner, but that's something that's hard to come by nowadays. There's somebody that's willing to go out and learn that.
Tell us a little bit about your favorite sets.
I like bait sets. I like cubbies. And we learned to make cubbies out of rocks. Around here, there's more rocks on the beach than anything. So we looked around for flat rocks, and we tried to make cubbies right at the junction of the high water mark and the timber. And the reason being that the mink here seem to travel the tide line, looking for something to drift in. And the cubbies just seem to be pretty doggone good, whether it's freezing weather, whether it's raining, and you have to make a lot of them. They don't always work. The mink will come around and look at them and then wander off again. And another reason for cubbies is you keep the birds out of them. We got squirrels here, you keep them out. And eagles, nowadays at least. Now, in the past, we didn't care because we sold them for bounty. But the eagle got in a trap, we killed them, kept the claws, and turned them into the post office. Got $3 a set for them. Nowadays, you don't want to catch an eagle. Be real careful on your cubbies and put them way back in so the eagles can't see them and get at them. For otter, of course, I never used a bait. I don't know whether anyone does, but we just find slides and places where they push off. Nowadays, of course, with the conibear type trap, it changed the whole picture of otter trapping, and I'm not sure that I like it or whether I don't. I used to like to be able to fool them. The type of sets that we use are strictly trail sets, blind sets, and like I said, some place where they use their stubby feet to jump off or push off. If you can get your trap in the right place, sometimes you even get them by both legs, and then they don't fight so much. So those two sets are just about people. In southeastern here, they might use the dirt hole type sets that we read about, but it's not my thing.
So what would be a good harvest for you? How many mink would you consider a good year?
100 would be a target, and I have to tell you that there's a lot of years we didn't get to it. Whether it was two of us or me alone, we would try for 100 mink. When the price was good, we were getting better than $20 a pelt. Well, then that was pretty much worth being out. And then otter would run from $40 to $60. And if we get 20, 25 otter, I'd be pretty happy. I was trying to remember the best combined season we ever had. I think we had 140 furs of mink and otter, and that's not counting marten. We got into the marten. I never was that interested in them, but I caught 100 marten too in a season, along with the rest of my fur, but I just wasn't interested in traipsing around the hills, and we just took what were in the beach sets.
Why weren't you interested in them? Not enough of a challenge?
No, I wasn't that, but the price was no good to start with. It's been, well, recent, 20 years, it's been a decent price. And I can remember getting $5 or $6. And then we had to skin the paws out and everything. I didn't want to go through that monkey business. On these islands here, they were just planted about at that time. And I can't honestly tell you, but I think it was in the 50s that those marten were planted from the mainland. And I know some people that did it. I know some people that captured marten and put them on these islands without anybody knowing it. They just did it. And so all of a sudden, there were marten around. And they were always orange, about the color of this paneling. And the oranger, the less price we got at that time. It didn't matter what the fur was like. I think they used them for chokers. And so for $6 or $7 a piece, I'd rather be out trying to get another otter. And I might get $60 for that, or less. And then, of course, mink took a downslide about that time. And then we couldn't seem to make it pay for catching numbers of mink anymore. So a lot of us, we switched over and we started taking more marten. And then making sets for them. I learned to make pole sets and tree sets and hollow log sets and things like that. That I got that out of that book that we were just looking at for Fish and Game. And some of those, my best sets I got out of there because it was country that I was not familiar with. We trap an outboard skiff here and we barely get out of sight of the skiff. We're right there on the tide line, and we got lots of coastline to do it, and that's the only way I've ever trapped. So it's just completely different.
Now tell us a little bit about how you would market your furs. Did you send them out through the mail, or was there a fur buyer that came around, or how did you do that?
The best experience I think I ever had was dealing with Sears Roebuck, and they were in business when I started, and we got our traps from them, we got all our equipment from them, and we sold our fur to them. And in Sitka, there was at least two fur buyers that I know of, local guys. One was Pete Hogan, and I don't know who those guys dealt with, Goldberg or somebody, the Seattle Fur Exchange. I sent furs to Mason, Stefan, and all of those companies in Seattle Fur Exchange, the old original one. But I think Sears Roebuck was my favorite over the years, and we never questioned sending our furs out by mail to getting a fair price. It seemed like we always did. And local guys, Pete Hogan, Adolph Thompson from Sitka. And Adolph Thompson used to come to Chichagof, I remember, when I was a kid. But I never sold furs to him, but I was too young then. And then another lady by the name of Peterson, she was the mother of Charlie Peterson, who's a well-known early-day pioneer here in the Sitka area. And she was an expert fur buyer, and you couldn't beat her. She was fun to sell to because you're just not going to get anywhere. She bought an otter from me that I got a little bit late in the spring one year. It was singed. It really wasn't the best, and then I kept it in the freezer all summer. I took it up to her, and it was an old board. It was a pretty big one. And she looked at me, and she figured I thought I was going to get away with something. But anyhow, she told me, she said, you can't expect it to buy something like that. On and on and on. And, you know, man, I was getting down in the dumps. I figured at least I'd get $15, $20 for it. And she finally gave me some money for it, but not much. But she said, don't you ever bring anything like that back to me again, you know. I learned. But who those people dealt with, I don't know. They went and turned and shipped their fur. They were local, and so we got paid cash. But you paid for it. But when we send ours to Sears, when we got that check back, to my knowledge, it was always fair and square. And I hated to see them get out of business.
Now, where did you send them to?
Sears in Seattle, Utah Avenue. Well, I almost remember the address. You know, they used to send us a whole lot of tickets every year for an otter. And in those days, we didn't have to tag anything. Now we've got a Sealy otter, and I think the marten, too. I don't believe we have to do anything with the mink. But some other fur, you know, interior fur, I think you have to seal them. And some of my relatives can send otter skins, sea otter. They can't sell them, but they send them down to have them tanned to use. But I can't do that, so I never bothered with anything like that. But you have to seal all that stuff now. So you got to go through the Fish and Game Office in Sitka or Juneau, whichever, for anybody here in the Pelican area. I've gone to both. There was a fur buyer in Juneau I sold quite a bit of fur to. I can't really remember his name, but I remember where he's located. He'd been there for years and years, and he was well known.
Any particular occasions when you thought you pulled one over on him, or vice versa, where they took you for a raw deal?
Not me. No, I can remember selling an exceptionally large mink one time to Pete Hogan, and he telling me it was a cotton mink. I didn't know what a cotton mink was in those days. But he said that he believed that it was a farmed animal from some place, but I got it on Baranoff Island. And there's no way it could have been. But he swore him down, and that's the only time that I ever remember arguing about fur. And I don't remember what he paid me for it, but I think he finally paid me to go on price just to quit arguing, because he also dealt in marine supplies, and I did a lot of business with him elsewhere. You asked me the question of getting the best of him, guys. No way. I was interested in learning. I followed that in both my fishing, commercial fishing career and my trapping career. Is I wanted to get the best price possible, so I wanted to know what I could do the best and how to take the best care of my fur and my fish. And so there's nothing except to learn from those people that bought my fur.
As president of the Trappers Association, I love all those stories about fur prices and harvests and populations, but we need to take a break here for a word from our sponsors. Thanks to our sponsors for supporting this program. Now let's get back to our interview with Jake Phillips of Pelican. In this next segment, Jake shares more about his trapping career and eagle bounties and deer hunting. You didn't mention wolves at all, and I think I know the answer, but why don't you tell us?
Well, I've seen a wolf or two up in the park, Latuya Bay area. We fished out of Latuya Bay quite a bit when we're trolling and longlining. And I've seen a few wolves, I've seen a few coyotes. But there's none on these islands close to home. Not, I've been told that there was a beaver got here on this island one time, and there was a lynx seen on this island at one time. But as far as catching them in a trap, it'd be very, very rare. I have a friend in Ketchikan that traps wolves, and he always was interested in me and joining forces and come on down there and do some trapping. But that was many years ago, and I never did it. Wasn't that interested in going anywhere.
You mentioned that the income was an important part of it for you. Was it Christmas presents for the kids, or was it food on the table, or some of both?
Well, by golly, Randy, I'll tell you, my career, I can name it 1952 or 53. I had obligations. I had a wife. I had a kid. There wasn't any money. There wasn't any. That was the lousiest fishing season I ever had. I think I made like $6,000 or $7,000 for the whole season. And even in those days, $6,000 or $7,000 didn't go. And there was no Christmas presents. There was no money to buy oil. There was no money to pay the bills. There was no jobs. I was in Sitka at the time. There was no jobs there. For me, at least, it was a necessity. We had roused around and borrowed trap. In those days, I believe that the season was every other year, and I don't know whether it was odd year or even year. I'm not sure. But we looked forward to trapping in the year that it was open, and we'd make plans a long time ahead. If some guys had decided that they weren't going to trap, well, they could lease their traps or borrow their equipment and maybe even trap on their lines, except that some guys didn't trap, but they wanted their lines to stay. And we used to pretty doggone well respect everybody's spot. There just was no money, and it was something I had to do. I had to get out and rustle because I was deer hunting anyhow. I needed deer to survive. As long as I was out deer hunting, I might as well be setting a few traps. And it's just kind of a natural thing to do. A lot of my friends were doing it, and I just went that way too. And some years, I'll tell you, it was skinny, but we managed to get by.
Do you remember any particular otter that was a real challenge or any incidents of unusual catches?
Well, yeah, I even got a three-legged mink one time, but by golly, sometimes mink are pretty dumb, I think. But by golly, an otter, I don't think I ever got an otter that was in a trap before in my career. But the otters, as far as I'm concerned, they're really smart. If I got close enough to an otter to identify him by his muzzle or his scar or something like that, well, I swear, by golly, I never saw him again. He was just too smart for me. And nothing ever stands out that I was the winner. But many, many times, I come back and find my trap. It wasn't wrecked like maybe a wolverine or something would do, but otter will spring traps, and then they'll drag them all over the place and lose them for you. I don't know why they do it or how they do it, but they do. Lots of times, if we've had a look for one of them 48 new house traps, and to finally find it, and they just spring it and then drag it away someplace. A lot of trappers won't believe it, but some old-timers do, and I know I sure do. Old Ted Kirkman, I mentioned him before. Some of his stories might have been a little bit far-fetched, but he swore up and down that he had an otter that sprung a trap with a stick and then drug the thing off with the stick so he wouldn't have to touch the trap. I wouldn't say it's not true.
Do you want to tell us any more about that Ted Kirkman? When we were on the boat before he came over here, I think you had a few stories about him.
He's the one that told me to shoot the otter in the traps because he said the problems that you're going to get trying to hit them to finish them off, you're going to have to club them. I mean, an otter are tough any way you cut it. He told me a story about somebody said drown them. That's the only way. Sure, fine and dandy. But how do you get the otter and the trap down to the bay if you don't have some certain set? I gotta explain one thing here in this country, in the salt water, is that you don't make your sets are in the salt water more than about 24 hours, or maybe even overnight, because we have what they call sand fleas. And the sand fleas will go right in and eat an otter inside out, and then there's nothing left of it. The skin's no good. So you gotta be really careful about your drowning type sets. Well, anyhow, Ted was telling me, get back to Ted and his story, he said, this guy told me, you drown him, there's nothing to it. He says, you just take the otter, and you got him by the chain, you take a stick and you hold him out here, and then you drag him down to the salt water and you hold him underneath. Well, according to Ted, he was wearing hip boots, and the otter got him by the toe. It didn't get his foot, but he got the boot, and he wouldn't let go, and he had this forked stick holding the otter away from him. The otter had him, and he waded out as deep as he could, and he had the trap chain and the whole business, and there he was one-legged trying to wade out in the water, and he was scared of that. I mean, otter, you don't want to take a chance with one of them animals. You know, they'd come at you, I'm sure. Anyhow, he waited and waited, and about the time he'd think that the otter was quit struggling, well, then he'd move. Ted told me that he said that was the worst fight that he ever had in his life, and he said he never wanted to do it again. So he said, kid, he said, make sure you pack your .22 with you. And I believe it. And I always pack a gun with me when I'm trapping otter.
Well, you mentioned seal hunting early on. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Like I said, we trapped every other year. And then the off-season was always seals. And I never was really that good at it. But, man, I got friends that killed all kinds of seals. And they even ran them from this town of Pelican to Prince Rupert to sell on the Canadian market. I don't know whether they were over in a park or what it was before a park or whether they could hunt seals in a park. Maybe they could, I don't know. But I know they used to go up to the west of us here in the wintertime and hunt seals on the ice. In this part of Alaska, we used to have, you know, 6, 8, 10 inches ice in some of the bays. All these seals all had their holes, and they'd come out and you'd catch them on the ice up there. And these guys were expert seal hunters. You read articles about them. I can't think of names. Well, Bill Hammer, Roscoe Max, and Ted Mossberg, those are friends of mine my age that did it. And like I say, I just shot them as an opportunist. Didn't really make a big effort to go on out, but when I shot one, I skinned it and took care of it and sold it. And when the bounty went off, well, then we still continued to shoot seals for the skins at the market.
Now, how much would you get for a seal hide?
By golly, I wished I could remember. We got $3 for the snout, but I think we got $20 for a good one. And then quite often we could make local deals with the native women.
Well, that seems like a lot of work for $20, because I can imagine skinning and fleshing one of those seals wasn't an easy thing.
Well, we didn't flesh them too much. We just kind of rolled them out of the hide, and that's pretty fast. I'm nowhere as fast as some of these people that do it for record, but I watched a guy on deck of a boat with a piece of plywood roll the seal out of there in about 20 minutes. And as far as I'm concerned, $20, that was the day's wages in those days. The guys that got good prices, like I said, took them someplace and then made a special deal. The ones that would just kill them more likely brought them back to town and gave them to some old lady that couldn't get out. Well, maybe we didn't get anything for them. Sometimes we got a set of moccasins, but it was all worth it. We got the bounty then, but I don't even remember when that went off.
You also talked about bounties on eagles. Tell us a little bit about that, maybe why it was in place.
I think they thought that they killed too many salmon. I really don't know why they had a bounty on an eagle. They're in the salmon creeks all the time, and you don't see them catching very many live ones. They usually feed on the remains. But there was a bounty on eagles for a good many years, and I think until DDT started depleting the flocks of eagles around the country. And maybe they were never depleted here, I don't know, but it seems like there are just as many eagles now as there was when I was a kid. But they get gun-shy. We used to stalk them. We didn't know they were nesting, you know. We didn't know anything about it in those days. Anyhow, there was a bounty on them, and then we used to go right to the post office. I think that's where we took the seal snouts, too. It seemed like eagles were only a dollar, but then they raised it. It wasn't much, but a kid with a .22, it isn't long before he's got a string of eagle claws.
Well, you also mentioned deer hunting, and of course that was a way to feed the family. Why don't you tell us about your favorite deer hunting spot and maybe the biggest deer you ever had or any other experiences along those lines?
One of my favorite places to hunt, obviously, when I was younger, it would go up timberline. Now my favorite place to hunt is out of the bow of my skiff. And I got a nice buck last year right out down around the corner. And I got out of the skiff all right because you're legally supposed to. And shot him on the beach. It was a beautiful setup, but the whole thing was perfect. But they don't get very many that way. But my favorite hunting was at timberline and the side hills. And one of the best places that I ever remember hunting was on the backside of the Arrowhead Verstovia Range. And we used to go up one ridge. The backside I meant would be the north side towards Blue Lake area and on the hillside in there. And when I grew up in Sitka, there was very few people that would go up in that area. And there was a road out to where the pulp mill is now. We'd go out that road there a ways and then hike up. And real brushy, real miserable going for a while. But once you got up on that side hill, and the Russians had cut timber up there at one time, and it was like a park up there, and just about timberline. And by golly, it's a beautiful deer up there. You'd sneak along there as early as you could get up there in the morning. It was almost impossible to not get one along that ridge somewhere. And then, of course, all you had to do was go ahead for the road, and sometimes you come out up by the lakes, and sometimes you came out back farther. But I got the biggest deer I ever got in there, and it weighed, was 148.5 pounds, and I won second prize, and I got a radio. I got a one here that might have been bigger, but we didn't weigh it. But I think that's a good-sized deer in a Sitka blacktail. And I would have never got that deer out because I shot two of them. And the other one was smaller. One of those opportune times, and I think one was laying down, one was standing up, and I got them both. And I was alone, which I used to like to hunt alone. But by golly, a guy heard me shoot, and he came up towards where I was. And I happened to know him. His name was Jay Kuhn, and he lived pretty close to where I lived in Sitka. His families lived there until they died just recently. Old-time family in Sitka. And Jay comes up to me, and seems like you can use a hand. I say, yeah, I sure can right now. And I don't believe I would have got that 148-pounder because at the time that's all I weighed myself. I don't know whether I'd have got that guy out of there without his help. But he helped me, and I gave him the other deer, and then he helped me get it down to weigh it. So that was pretty neat. Can't forget that story. That was my favorite place of hunting for many, many years.
I hope you're enjoying these fascinating stories of life in the woods from Jake Phillips of Pelican. Tune in to Alaska Tracks again next week when we'll hear more of his experiences.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.